Thanks, James. Hello. See, if we would have talked for 15 more minutes, he could have given you the rest of the story. I wouldn't even have had to come up here. But thank you for those kind words. It is a pleasure to be asked to come here and hang out this weekend and just to share my story. For so many years, most of my life, other people have been telling my story for me. My parents, you know, they had their version of my story, and I had to start paying lawyers to tell my version of the story, and the DA had their version of the story, and I had five or six different stories that I was trying to keep up with all at once, and God help me if I forgot a little detail and got caught up in one of my lies. It sure is a gift today to be able to stand up here, just another man to man, and not have to remember what I did last night or what I told, you know, one of you out there on the yard today or last night, you know, because it was me just trying to be somebody that you liked to fit in. You Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. And we'll get into that. But I just want to say thank you. Thank you, Tim, for inviting me. We've been talking for over a year now, and really kind man. You and Vic picked me up from the airport, and I really appreciate that. Thank you for the committee, Craig, and everyone else who served on the committee. This is it takes a lot of effort to get one of these things going, so I don't want to go without saying thank you to every person who had something to do with putting this on this year and then the 34 years past. What an awesome weekend. And it's been great meeting a lot of you and the other speakers, too. Palmer, Tim, thank you so much for sharing a message that has depth and weight that really, really spoke to my heart. And the history from Rick last night, that was awesome, too. All of that is great, but my favorite parts of this weekend have been just the one-on-one, you know, those talks in the line and out on the bench, and just those, they're priceless, you know, and I definitely cherish those. So thank you for inviting me here and for welcoming me into this this amazing conference. And my name's Matt, and I am an alcoholic. Amen. I'm glad I know that today. My sobriety date's May 1st of 2008. I have a home group, the High Noon Group. We're just outside of Nashville, and we meet every day at noon. We'd love to have you if you're ever in the area. I'm not as active in that group as I used to be due to my work schedule. I found that once you get employable in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's harder to make a noon meeting. However, I still think they're the best thing going, so I haven't found it necessary to change home groups yet, but I'm one thing at a time. I have a sponsor, and I also have the ability, you know, the privilege to share with some other guys what I've been so freely given. And all of those things help me stay right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that wasn't always the case, because to be honest with you, I didn't come here looking for new friends, and I didn't even really want to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, to be honest with you. I didn't really want anybody in to know who I was or what I was going through. I pushed away as far as I could until there was really no other outs besides the bitter end. So just to touch on a couple things, how did I get here? One of the earliest memories I have was just, you know, as we've already heard so beautifully put by Palmer and Tim earlier this weekend, just that feeling of apart from or irritable and restless and discontent from as early as I can remember. Several years ago, my mom had reminded me of this time when I was about 3 years old. I went up to her and my dad, and as serious as a 3-year-old can be, and said, you know, I know that I'm adopted, and I need to know where my real family is. Just as serious as can be. I'm like, and they started laughing at me, and they're like, oh, you know, this is, you know, all you got, and this is us. And I've done some research since then, and they are who they say they are. So we're spared there. But that didn't stop that feeling inside of me that, you know, I don't belong to this world, really. You know, and even these people who brought me into this world, they were like aliens to me, or rather, I was the alien and trying to just blend in, to try to get by. And those were the skills that I learned, you know, from an early age, just to get, you know, to get by, to fake it till you make it kind of attitude. And my dad one time I was acting out in the restaurant and flopping all over the place, you know, doing whatever, and he's like, you know, act like you've been here before. And I had been to a restaurant before, but that, just that right there, is something I took with me through the early years of my adulthood. And even though now it's like, you know, I'm not going to let you know that I need help. I'm just going to act like I've been here before. You know, I'm just going to keep nodding my head, you know, sure, yeah, uh-huh. I just wanted to be one of the guys, but for whatever reason, something inside my mind said that there was something missing. And that I couldn't be one of you because you knew that I wasn't one of you. I wasn't just another one of God's kids. Apparently, in my mind, I was different. And I had these voices going on in my head. There's very active, and they forced me to want to plan things. You know, like when you'd go up to the girl and you'd have this scenario of how things were going to happen, and I'm like, I'm going to say this, she's going to say this, then I'm going to be like, you know, well, hey, this is great, and this is going to happen. I'd remember being at home at night and having these, like, okay, this is what's going to happen. And then I'd go up to her, and just, you know, mashed potatoes would fall out of my mouth, and like, blah, you know, and then I'd feel really embarrassed, and, you know, I have to walk away. And I'm like, that didn't work out really well. And then at age 12, something happened for me. The year going into sixth grade, I'd started playing soccer very competitively, and my best friend at the time, it was a summer, and we were hanging out at his house, and we found his mom's half gallon of vodka above the washing and dryer machine. And the fact that we found it makes me think that we were looking for it for a while, and I don't know how long we were looking for it, but we found it that night, And it ended up changing my life. We poured off water bottles each and a splash of orange juice. Ran off into the woods because that's where we hung out when we were younger. And run through the woods and sat down by this tree and popped open this little screwdriver cocktail thing and just put it down. And at first, I thought that it was rubbing alcohol, and because my esophagus started to swell up, and I was like, oh man, we got the wrong stuff. And then 2 seconds later, it happened. And the first time in my long 12-year life that I finally felt okay. All of those voices, all of that trying to figure it out, all of those insecurities, that fear that was just deep, deep to the bone, it was all gone. And I remember laying there, could almost tell you exactly where it was, and for the first time in my life, I was at one with the world. It was okay. Whatever was happening, like, this is it. This is what I've been missing. This is the thing everybody else was doing that I didn't have access to. This is the answer. And it's interesting, and Rick touched on it last night, Carl Jung, who's one of our, the Swiss psychiatrist who ended up helping Roland in his quest for relief, he came up with this, you know, concept that alcoholics of our type, you know, we're thirsty. We have this thirst for spirits. And the Latin word, like you mentioned, you know, for spirits and is the same for God as it is for the poison substance that we put in our body. See, the thing is that I was thirsty for God from day one, but I found that vodka first, and it worked. I mean, and it did something inside of me that I had been looking for. So at 12, you know, I had my resources were very limited as far as, you know, how I could get this substance. She would, you know, we'd have to be very careful about how much we stole from her. And the problem was at 12, I didn't have the resources I needed to have to keep this party going. But I did find that my parents had a stash too. And so we divided and conquered, and we could pull our resources together from various places. And I mean, it wasn't an every weekend thing, but I couldn't wait to do it again. And so it continued. And I found out that you can't put water back into the vodka when it's in the freezer. That's a hard one to explain, just in case you didn't know that. And I remember just the thrill I got from the chase and from getting all the materials, going off into the woods or wherever, you know, and then recreating that. And I would continue to drink to try to recreate that night at 12 years old for the next, you know, 10 plus years. And each time I had to give a little bit more for that next one. And I stole. It's funny because I stole my first drink, and I stole a lot of things, a lot, between that first drink and my last drink. This disease, you know, which I come to learn as it is, I mean, it doesn't care. It doesn't. In the throes, if you're in my way, I mean, I'm sorry, you got to go. I'll tell you what you need to hear. I'll charm you. I'm the guy that, you know, is selfish and self-centered, but really, really kind while doing it. You know, I didn't know that. That's possible. I mean, not until you found me and got me into this book. But I mean, otherwise, I had a really good upbringing and very competitive in sports. And as long as I was doing that, it seemed like I could party and nobody was giving me a hard time. My grades, I wasn't really a great student, but again, with the sports being the main focus, you can kind of get by on some other areas. When I started driving, things changed because now my resources were in abundance and I could drink on lunch breaks and until they picked up on that. I didn't know that vodka you could smell on your breath, but they told me otherwise, that my high school I went to, they didn't like you coming back after. I thought I was doing them a favor by showing up to class, but after drinking, it's not a good idea to go to school. So I'm driving, and I found that, like James was talking about, when I started to drink, you know, I like to travel a little bit. And this one night we were at a pregame party before the party, and we're going to the party, and I just got a brand new car, and I have about 5 people in it. It's a 2-door coupe, and I'm going a little bit faster than I should have, and then I step on the pedal and punch it, go right through a stop sign, over this embankment, come crashing down into the person's front yard, right over a tree stump that was cut down a few days before that would have split my car in half. And I come crashing down, and I try to get out of out of the door, and I can't because the door's, you know, jammed up, smoke's everywhere. So I do what, you know, Jeff Gordon would have done and jumped out the window and run down the street. No regard whatsoever for anybody in the car. That's what I do. I run. When things happen and I'm I hit a roadblock, I run. I mean, and that's what I've been doing my whole life up to this point. I run down about 25 strides, and then I look back, and it's really dark for one, and I can't see too much further, so I'm not thinking this running thing's going to be a good idea. And I look back, and there comes another friend who was following me, saw the whole thing went down. Nobody in his car. He had, like, a station wagon. And we all hopped into there. Luckily, by the grace of God, no one was seriously injured. And we went to the party. Makes sense, right? So on the way, this was right at the, it was in the late 90s. So, I mean, I have, for some reason, I feel like I had a cell phone. And it was probably like in a briefcase or something. But the, I called home. I was like, you wouldn't believe what happened. Somebody stole my car. And I thought that was a good and my mom was like, we already know what happened. The police are here. And be back at the car, you know, in 15 minutes. So I'm thinking like, oh, man. So I go to the party, put a couple down, go back to the scene of the accident. And when I get there, there's two deputies on scene, and they look at me. My mom's there, and look, you know, son, have you had anything to drink? And I said, well, officer, I'm going to be honest. I had one after the accident, but I didn't have anything before. He said, that's a good answer. And I said, yeah, I know it is. I don't know where it came from, but I just, I'm just thinking to myself, man, this is. And so it went, you know. I'm one of those real smart alcoholics. I know that I've worked with enough of you guys to know you're out there too, you know, educated beyond your intelligence. You know, that's me. You know, it's like I continue on. I got off, you know, slap on the wrist, and a couple months later, I borrowed my parents' car. I don't know if they thought I was borrowing it or not. It might have been considered stealing, but we're family, so. And I'm hanging out with some of my older friends. Most of my friends by this time, I mean, they're a little bit older. I was hanging out with the older guys. They had more connections and things that I was interested in. And they got me into my first ever, gentleman's club. And this is all happening in Raleigh, North Carolina, by the way. Put you on the map. And I go into this place, and, you know, I'm like, all right. That boy who's, you know, 12 years old and insecure and everything and fear running rampant is there. And I go to the bar and I order a Maker's and Ginger had one. All right, you know, had two. By the time I'm done about the second one, it's starting to happen. And on my way to get the third, you know, I see these two blondes that are standing over there. And I go up and I tell them, you know, where I've been the last 16 years of their lives, and they're 23, I believe, at the time, and that was pretty old, and we laughed and ended up going back over to their place about 2-3 in the morning. I'm driving, because that's what I do, and I got a lesson that, you know, a lot of us, I'm sure, have had, where, you know, that flashlight in the side mirror doesn't always mean a good thing. There's not a UFOs coming in behind you. There was an officer who told me to pull over, and apparently it took me a while to actually pull over because of the way the road was situated. And after I did, I realized, or they informed me, that you can actually get pulled over for driving under the speed limit. They didn't tell me that in driver's ed. And going left to center doesn't help. So I'm 17 years old at this time. Probably had enough reason not to continue driving, let alone drinking and driving. And now I'm in jail on my first DUI charge. And I do what I do when I get into trouble. I go and I call home. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning now. My dad picks up the phone. Hey, Dad, you know, I'm in jail. And he's like, I'll think about coming to get you in the morning. Click. I'm like, okay, that went well. Still in jail, and I don't have anybody else to call, so here we're going to, you know, I don't know if I slept much that night, but when I did get out the next morning, I figured that, you know what, I just got to, you know, figure out another way to get around. You know, this driving thing is probably not going to happen. And that was my only thought, was I just got to figure out a way now, maybe a girlfriend or somebody, I'm going to need access to a vehicle. Not that maybe drinking is an issue. So as a result of this DUI, I had to go to an assessment to get one of these alcohol assessments, and where you go and you sit down at a table and this guy asks you about 1,000 questions, and it's I'm a smart alcoholic. So I'm like, no problem, I'll take this test. And I failed the test and or passed it, I don't know, whoever. Who, it depends who created it. And I ended up saying, they ended up telling me that I had to go to the ANA. And I was like, hey, you kidding me? Like, this is for alcoholics, you know? I drink, you know, top shelf vodka, and I just, you know, got caught a couple times. I mean, I'm not an alcoholic, so whatever. I know how to play by the rules. I'll play by your rules. I'll do what you say, you know, for me to do, just so you get you off my back, and I can go ahead and do what I need to do. So I go to the AA. And I remember, I'll never forget this night. It's in a church basement, go figure. I walk down there, and I mean, there's so much smoke, I can't even see the other wall, for one. And then as I'm walking in, you know, I start to see there's people here, and smoke clears, and I was like, man, these people are really old. I mean, like Tales from the Crypt kind of old, like, you know, like, I didn't... this is like, I think maybe some of them were the first 100 that wrote the book. I mean, I really, and they were really nice, like grandma and grandpa, you know, like, hey, you know. And that's, I remember them saying, like, you know, keep coming back or something. And I was like, yeah, well, we'll see you in about 50 years, you know, like, don't drive tonight, please. I mean, that was my mentality, you know, like, God, I couldn't be an alcoholic. I mean, those people, I mean, I have alcoholics in my family tree, you know, a few, and I know the damage that they caused, and I wasn't like that. You know, I was just having fun. You know, I'd got caught a couple times. No big deal. I didn't realize that I had already crossed over that invisible line into alcoholism, where I didn't have the choice not to drink. See, in reading that first step, when I was coming around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous a lot, I thought that it said that, you know, by being powerless over alcohol, and then my life had become unmanageable, I thought that said that I can never drink again, which it suggested. However, further study, it actually states to me that the time and place will come that I will drink again, and I don't have a choice not to. My only defense has to be a power greater than myself, but we already know what that power was, is that vodka in the summer night when I was 12. Well, I play by their rules, and I get a little slap on the wrist, and this is back in like late 90s, where, you know, DUIs weren't as, I guess, severe as they are today, and I got off, and maybe because I wasn't 18, I don't know, and I just continued to do what we do. And I got moved around to a couple different schools. My behavior wasn't consistent with the standards of public facilities and or the laws of the land, and I just didn't care, to be honest with you. I was in my own world, and I needed this to be okay. You know, like we had heard earlier, it wasn't so much my problem as it was my solution for life. And so I continued to go, and after another, as a consequence for another piece of trouble I was in, and by this time, I mentioned my soccer earlier, I had already made this subconscious decision to live this party, this fantasy world that I had created for myself. instead of playing Division I soccer, which was an option had I remained healthy and continued on the path. But at the time, I mean, it was just, you know, I wasn't making that choice. It was just, I didn't have the choice. This was it. You know, alcohol had me and I was gone. And I moved from the middle of the state to the mountains, thinking that that was going to solve the problems. And I found me there and even better supply. You know, I started drinking moonshine and some char, and that was really economical, I'd say. You know, I was a really nice guy. I used to give it to people as gifts because I knew they wouldn't drink it, and I could go over and drink some when I was at their house. So I was hiding it at their houses, and I mean, I thought that was pretty clever. And it's like, you know, I was making money. I had, you know, had some cars, and on the outside, everything looked okay. I'm traveling a lot. We're like snowboarding in the winter times and going all over. I'm going to New York and just spending money and making money, and my life is good, right? Everything's okay. As long as I have that stuff, I'm okay. But inside, I'm still trying to kill myself. Just pour, I can't get enough poison down me. And I'm in the mountains now. I'm in Asheville. I'm like 19 years old at this point, and we used to longboard, like a long skateboard, in the fall and in the summer months when we weren't snowboarding. And I was going down this new run, and I came to the bottom of the hill, and I was going to do a power slide, which is basically to stop. And don't remember what happened, but it didn't work out as I was planning. And I ended up hitting a head to concrete going about 10 miles an hour downhill. By the grace of God, my roommate was there at the time and was able to call an ambulance. I wasn't drunk. I'd had a couple in me, but I wasn't drunk. I had just enough, you know, to try something maybe I wouldn't have normally done. But I was dead on arrival, and they had to perform a last, you know, resort surgery where they removed part of my head and let the brain swell, and it started several months of rehabilitation after I got through ICU and all that stuff. And long story short, I had to learn how to walk and talk again and put on shoes, the right feet, and all of this, you know, therapy. And I get out. I remember I was like chasing people down for cigarettes up and down the ward. They said that was pretty comical, and I said I'd done some things that were what made people laugh, which I don't know if that's something to be proud of or not. But I was starting to take my form. But as soon as I got out that day, my buddy picked me up and passed me a flask and a one of those medicinal cigarettes that I don't think are legal in that state right now. But and I was back to it. Like I didn't miss a beat. And this time now I had some high-powered pain medicine that would require me to consume less alcohol to get the same effect, if not more. So I could really manage, so I thought, my consumption of alcohol while taking this other stuff. And thus began the dark years. It wasn't long before my behaviors with that particular stuff forced them to not give me that stuff anymore. Because I was checking myself into detox, because that's another behavior I learned, that if the law is looking for you, you can check yourself into detox to hide out for a couple days. And I started to run with some different types, and started to do things that I was taught not to do. And I had the moral compass through my upbringing, you know, to live by certain standards, and all of that stuff was gone. Alcohol had I'd given it away. It had taken that from me, and I remember there wasn't enough whiskey to pour down to make that hole, you know, fill anymore. It wasn't just I wasn't okay, and there was a couple nights where I went to sleep passed out, really hoping that I wouldn't wake up the next day. And to wake up the next day was just the worst. Because there were certain things that were happening during that time that, you know, I really knew that it weren't, you know, weren't okay. And my last ditch effort to try to get some sanity in my life was, like, to find this girl. Or to get into a relationship, I guess. And I love to hear the way that that women are described by the men I've heard talk from Alan on this weekend, because I get that. I get the bottle with the legs or something like that. I mean, they're just as much of a thrill and a chase than just about anything else out there. And but that's for the signalist of purpose. I'm not going to go down that route. Let's just say that, you know, when I'm thirsting for God, whiskey, women, money, and a lot of other things are a temporary fix, like a sugar high. They don't last forever, and they always leave me wanting more. And so I got into a relationship, and, you know, I needed a girl I could trust, because I'm living in, like, kind of a dark area, right? I'm living in Gotham City, and living in a motel under an alias, paying cash by the week, that type of thing. Just in case they find me, they're not going to know who I am. It's going to take them a while. Hadn't talked to my parents in months, and I felt like I could trust her because, you know, she just got out of prison, and it made sense to me then. I mean, I talked to your sponsor first before making this type of decision, but, you know, she had some outside issues, and, you know, we got along just great, and she was Bonnie, and I was Clyde, you know, this started just another two-year cycle of spree and remorse, and I started ending up in places I couldn't get out of around this time, more frequently, you know, with, I like to drive. They didn't like me driving when the way I was, and I was blacking out a lot. I was waking up in different cities and in different places, and it was always like a mystery when you woke up in the morning. When I woke up, I was looking around like, okay, I felt like a detective, you know, like trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together, and okay, where am I? Like, okay, who's this? You know, looking at the pictures on the walls and trying to pull together any pieces of information I can to tell me where I am. And then the scariest part was, where's the car? And I remember some of those frightful mornings or afternoons, whenever it was, that but the thing about it is, no matter how bad of an experience that happened, no matter what I did, no matter how off my moral compass it was, it didn't matter. I had a solution that could make all of that go away, at least temporarily. And when some of that stuff started to catch up with me, they put me in jail, and I was in treatment centers, and people like you started to come in and see me, and I don't know why you were always there. I mean, it was kind of creepy, to be honest with you, and because I got put somewhere, I'm trying to figure out where I am, and all of a sudden, AA meeting, and I'm like, God dang, these people are following me. I mean, I can't get away from you. And I had come around, and I emphasize around, Alcoholics Anonymous to know that there was something going on. But yet, I was sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, hearing the laughter, seeing the people, you know, with bright eyes, and thinking it was just all, you know, a crock, because I'm sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous on the edges, wanting to kill myself, just like I was in that little motel room, because I wasn't doing what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous were doing. I was irritable, restless, and discontent. I didn't know how to live without drinking. And the proposition was just like, you know what, I don't know if it's worth it. But I kept, you know, hearing, you know, the things that you were saying, and I was like, okay, you know, I do kind of half of what you suggested. And it's pretty clear in how it works that half measures availed us nothing. So it's by no surprise that, you know, I didn't get the full, you know, the full rewards. And I had a really difficult time getting anything more than 56 days. That was the most. There was something inside of me, the mental obsession, that kicked in overdrive right around 55 days. Like, I could be locked up 30 days, come out, go to a meeting, had a sponsor. Well, actually, I really just had a phone number. There's a big difference. I would later find out. And I go to a meeting, like, okay, all right, I go to a meeting, I'm okay, and I go home, and I just sit there, and I do whatever I do, and I go to a meeting the next day, and everything's okay. You know, I go to work, everything's okay, and this would continue for about a week or so, and then I'd get paid, and I'd be like, well, okay, and then it was always a choice, like, should I go bail what's-her-name out, or should I go get a bottle, or, hey, maybe I can do both this week, because it was a good week. What do you know? And that's what I did. And this, my last spree was on a payday. It started on a payday, and I get her out, and I go to have a Mexican. And by this time, I'm about 55 days sober, mind you, and I'm doing okay. I don't have a sponsor. I haven't worked any steps, but I'm just holding on, really, bare knuckle. And I'm at a Mexican restaurant, and I start to have some nachos, and, you know, all of a sudden, it's just like, you know, this, I need a Corona. Like, I mean, this is just the next right thing. And it's just a Corona. I mean, that stuff's, like, hardly alcoholic. So, I mean, I'll just have one. One, two, three later, and then it's like Jose, you know, shows up, and, you know, Katie barred the door. I'm gone. And there was always something in my mind was kind of an all or nothing. And especially when it relates to alcohol, I cross over, and I don't know when I'm going to stop. I mean, to be honest, towards the last 5 years of my drinking, I couldn't tell you when the party was going to stop. I mean, it was driving. Like, I love that analogy. And when this party stopped, I was driving home to say goodbye to my mom and my dog, because those were really only two things that would have anything to do with me, and get a change of clothes. I'd been living in a 96 Buick with her, and I wasn't homeless. Things weren't that bad. It was like a mobile home. Not even big enough for one of us, let alone both of us. And I pull into the neighborhood, and you know, there's some law enforcement agencies waiting for me, and they said, where have you been? And I said, well, you know, I just was down at the store getting some milk. And they said, you know, nice try, get out of the car. And I'd crossed over another line, and I get put back in the back of a service vehicle, and I'm looked back, and there's now a row of state law enforcement agencies on this mountain town, on this mountain road that my parents live in. And 5 minutes later, you know, my mom comes driving up the road, and she's talking with one of the detectives, and I see her drive by, and the only thing that I can relate it to would be a mother standing over her son's casket. The distraught look on her face and the tears. It was like, it was one of the saddest things I've seen. And I'd become so calloused at that point that I didn't think I had feelings. But the last feeling I had inside of me, like, snapped. And I cried out that prayer that I've heard others since use, and it was just, God, help me. I can't live like this anymore. I need to know. I'll do anything it takes. And right after that came out, the first thought that came to my mind were those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, all right. Okay. And I'd love to tell you that, you know, I got out on bail that day, and they let me go home, and I got a home group, and I've been active ever since in that group. But that wasn't the story. I get taken to a federal detention facility, and I'm facing 929 months. And I'm 23 years old at the time. Nobody's going to have anything to do with me because I've taken from everybody. I'm locked up 23 hours and 50 minutes a day. For the 10 minutes that I have out to make a phone call, I have no one to call. I just sat there because I wanted to get out of the cell. And I'm sitting in there, and more charges are sliding under my door. It's not getting good for the home team. When a newcomer comes into my home group, I don't tell them, you know, hang out, it's going to get better. Because for me, I'm at one day sober, and it's not getting better. I was starting to literally, you know, break inside. And it was everything I could do to just to hang on. And I don't remember a lot of those early days, but it was a very scary time. And then a man came to a jail, and that's why I'm here today, to be honest. A member of Alcoholics Anonymous came to a jail, like you guys do, and he brought this big book, and he brought a meeting to us. And this was, it might have been a month or so now after everything had gone down, and I don't remember a single thing this man said in the meeting. I'm going to be honest with you. But I remember one thing. At the end of the meeting, he left. He got in the elevator, and he went down to his car, and presumably his family or his dog or whatever. And I went back to my world, which is as big as, you know, a bathroom. And that was attraction. Like, I really wanted what that guy had. And, yeah, I mean, it was. So I kept going to meetings whenever they were available. And at the same time I'm locked up, my dad gets diagnosed with a very rare form of terminal cancer, and they give him 18 months. Keep in mind, I'm facing 929. For whatever reason, felt it, you know, my parents, who I've taken from, and everything, they pulled some resources together. I don't know how they did it, but they got me a good lawyer, and even then, he was like 7 to 11 is the best we can do. Years. And through this whole process, I mean, there's a lot of things going on, and I just keep seeking. I keep seeking spiritual solution, and I just start to pray with my eyes open, and I'm just like, you know what, I'm done. I mean, this is what Matt's life looks like run by Matt. And my lawyer, you know, had a good day in court, and I ended up only having to do 2 years state penitentiary, only two, but I mean, it's a long 2 years, but the I think there was a lot of grace in that, no doubt about it. And I show up after processing in maximum security. I was able to get medium security, which allowed a little more freedom as far as, you know, getting out of the cell at least. And started to have the opportunity. I had to go to a counselor and talk to them about getting signed up on the AA list. Well, before that, we had to take either a class or go to work. And of course, I needed some money, so I wanted to go to work. And they said, nope, sorry, you have to take a class. Well, all right, why'd you ask me about that work? But I, what class do you want to take? Well, I'm hungry at this point. I'm like, you know, starting to try to put on some weight. And I'd like to take the baking class or the home ec class where you get to make food. Oh, sorry, that class is full. Well, why'd you offer it? This is the way the system works, and it really tries your patience. And, well, I saw that they had a horticulture class, and I knew a little something about growing closet tomatoes, and I was like, well, this will be good. You know, maybe I'll get to grow my own food. And so I signed up for that class, and this class was huge in my life. And now keep in mind, I'm like 3 months sober at this time. I'm starting to get into a more of a normal routine as far as going to meetings. And this horticulture class, it taught me a lot. One, about just like showing up on time, you know, because they help you to do that, but it does make a big difference with performance. And this is also where I met my first sponsor. His name was Terry, and Terry was doing 15 for very similar charges that I had. He was on a different side of town or a different part of the state, and maybe he didn't have the lawyer that I had, I don't know. But Terry was walking around with grace and dignity in a place that was by all means very callous and cold and dark, and he would end up being my sponsor. But it also, this class also taught me something very, very important with my understanding or lack thereof of God, and in that, you know, we would you know, learn about plants and things and how to sow seed. But as we would plant the seed, you know, I would see that there's really little that I do from taking it from seed to plant. You know, there is something there, like from the seed to the plant. And alcoholics of my type, we're just like seeds that people, you know, try to throw away. They cast us out and forget about us. We're dead to the world. But then something happens through AA, through the power, who I choose to call God, comes in and waters and fertilizes these seeds, and they begin to grow, regardless of where we're planted. Be it inside of prison, or be it out in, Brownwood, Texas. And so I began to see, you know, that this God that I had heard about so many, you know, times, and that maybe he would care about me too. If he's caring about this little seed, he's taking care of it. You know what? Maybe I have a chance. And so Terry would become my sponsor, and we would sit out on the yard every Sunday and read this book. He would read, and I would listen. And that was not by my choice. That was what he told me we were going to do. I'm like, Terry, I can read, man. He's like, no, you need to listen. And I was like, okay. And then he would say things to me like, man, don't think. And I was like, what? Like, are you kidding me? Like, how am I not going to, I'm going to get hurt if I don't think out here. And that wasn't the mission. You know, the mission was just to get out of my head. And I had to have steps to do that. I had to have direction from a good sponsor to say, hey, what have you done for somebody else today? I'm like, well, nothing. I mean, come on, it's all about me, right? We started to go through the steps, and things started to happen. I remember at one point, you know, looking at myself in one of those aluminum foil mirrors and actually smiling, you know, for the first time. And I feel muscles in my face, you know, like that I hadn't felt in a long, you know, like this is, wow, this is what it feels like to smile. And I was at the, we were reading this book, and I really wanted my own book because they had copies at the place, but I wanted to be able to underline it and things. And Terry told me that there was an address in the back that I could write to, box 459. So I didn't have anything else to do. I wrote a letter. And I got a response back, and it was from a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and from New York that said, you know, we're thank you for writing. It sounds like you paid an awful lot for your alcoholism. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We hope you find the fellowship you crave. And for a man sitting inside that didn't have anybody on the outside who'd come back into his life, that meant so much. And I realize today that that's possible because somebody put a dollar in a basket and that their treasurer sent that money up to GSO and that GSO bought some big books and other literature to send to guys like me sitting inside with nobody else to help. And so I continued to follow the directions of my sponsor and work the program to the best of his ability. And things started to change. My perception of things started to change. We did my four. There was a couple things on my four step. I wasn't going to confess to another inmate for obvious reasons. And I told him that, and he was okay with that. We got into eight, and I had a list of people who I had harmed, and he said, now, later, or never, next to each one. We looked at each one, and now meant, in his mind, when I got home. Later, never, you know, you get the idea. And when, shortly after that, I moved to another facility, and he got me plugged in with this other guy. His name's Juan, and it's crazy. The first days going into a new penitentiary are probably some of the scariest, for me at least, because I didn't know anybody. I was looking lay of the land. The rules have changed. There's a whole new environment. You're just kind of having to be ears open, but and eyes open the whole time. But the one thing I did was find Alcoholics Anonymous as soon as I got there, and by the grace of God, you know, that was my protection. And when I got to this new facility, I got a guy named Juan, who's in our family, our lineage, and Juan said, now means now. You need to pick up a piece of paper and write for some of these amends that I needed to make. And what I did was, for those who weren't going to be able to come visit me, was able to write letters. My mom, at the top of the list, had done everything but physically harm this woman. So I wrote her a letter, and I followed the directions in the book and said, you know, this is what I did, and I need to know what I can do right now to make this right. You know, my life depends on it. And I got a letter a few days after, and she said that, Matt, the only thing that we want from you is for you to love yourself like we love you. And I don't know if those emotions were right on the edge of my skin or what, but I just lost it. I began to weep, and it's not really a cool thing to do when you're in prison, but I could care less at that time. And I'd realized, too, that my mom was a channel of my understanding of God today, and that God just wants me to love me as much as he loves me. It's a hard thing to do sometimes, but the steps have made that possible. By clearing away this stuff of what I've done, I realized that that's not who I am today. And so I continue on, and actually I find a priest who I'm still close with today. He's become a good friend of mine to do the remaining fifth step with, to confide in him and get rid of everything that I've been carrying with me this whole while. And Father G took it with love, with grace, and I felt at once that, you know what, I was following the directions that are outlined in this book and starting to feel some of the rewards. A couple days after that, I'm walking out onto the yard, and all of a sudden I'm standing there at the top of the hill, and I look out, and I don't see any of the towers. The gun towers are gone, the fences, the barbed wire, they're not there. I don't see anybody else out on the yard. I'm standing here inside of this prison a free man for the first time. And I felt the sun come over me, and I realized at that point, you know, that I was okay. That I was free inside of a prison, and that I was doing time well before I got there. So we don't have to go into jails and prisons to live in a jail and a prison. This disease has us in bondage, as it says. And so I'd continue to work the steps, and things started to happen. One of the things that happened that was really strange to me is that one day I was going up to the mail room to get some mail, and they said that the mail wasn't written right, so I couldn't get it. And I mean, what a stupid rule, you know? Like, they don't have that out. I mean, it was really just, you know. And so I had to tell them, given my analysis of their rules, and I just, you know, I told her what was up, and then I left and walked back down to my pod, and I sat there for a second. I was like, you know, you could have handled that a lot better. And I walked up there because I was told that, you know, if you have to eat crow, you got to eat it while it's warm. And so I went up there, you know, my tail between my legs, and I was like, you know, I'm wrong. I could have said that better. She was like about to call for backup, you know, as soon as she saw me. But once I started talking, she was like, wow, you know, like, no, you know, no problem. And I started to work the steps before actually working the steps, and continued to take personal inventory. I promptly admit it when I'm wrong, not if I'm wrong. It tells me that when I'm wrong, you know, that's going to happen. But it is amazing for me, for the guy who is always running from catching himself doing, you know, getting caught, to actually being able to look life in the eye and say, you know what, I was wrong for the way I handled that situation. Didn't change the outcome, I'm going to tell you. Like, she didn't say, oh, well, here's your mail now. But my world got a little bit bigger, and I got to live in it a little bit easier. I didn't have to worry about that mail lady the next time I went to get my mail. And I got a chance to make amends to my dad while I was in prison, because his condition obviously was getting worse, and I was privileged to do that. And when I got home, well, before I got home, I'm going to tell you this story real quick. I get a sponsor at the last facility I was at. His name's Bob, and Bob S. He goes to prison, so he doesn't go to prison. That's his thing. And he'd been taking meetings to that facility for 20 something years, and he was my sponsor. He agreed to be my sponsor in my last couple months I was in, and he was real big on service. When I got home, when I was released, I moved from North Carolina to Tennessee, and he said, you need to get a home group, you need to get a service commitment, and you need to look for guys to take through the steps. I was like, all right, well, my dad picked me up, you know, by grace, God's grace. You know, he was okay. He wasn't in really good shape, but he picked me up. We moved to Tennessee, where they were. I heard they had AA in Tennessee, so I was pretty happy about that. And Bob said he knew a guy that knew a guy in Tennessee, in Nashville. So I was like, okay, cool. You know, thinking that this is like the mob or something, like they know people, and like, you know, Paulie's going to pick me up from the airport, and we're going to get to work, and like, let's go. So he ended up introducing me to Scott, who presently is my sponsor, but he wasn't at the time. He was just the first face of Alcoholics Anonymous that I met in Tennessee. And I never forget, you know, upon meeting him, he put his arms around me and gave me this really big hug. And it wasn't like one of the bro hugs that I was used to at this point in my life. You know, like, he didn't let go. And I was, for a split second, I felt really uncomfortable. And then I let go. And I just let him, he's like, I'm really glad you're here. Nobody had ever told me they were glad I was here. Ever. And he kind of took me under his wing, you know. And we would go out and do fun things and hang out. And Just do things that, you know, I didn't think were going to be available in sobriety, like going to a hockey game or going fishing or, you know, fun things. You know, because at 23 years old, I think, you know what, I'm going to stop drinking, you know, my life's going to be over. You might as well put one in the back of my head while I'm not looking, just because, I mean, there's going to be no point. And through this process, you know, like I said, I knew my mom and my dad and now Scott, and Bob told me to get a home group. So I show up to the first group the next day, is at noon. And I tell him, you know, hey, my name's Matt. I'm just got out of prison, and I'm happy to be here or something. I was really awkward and like I am now, and socially anxious about people, like being able to leave the meetings when I wanted to, and it was weird. But they loved me anyways, you know. They didn't hold that against me, and it was really awesome to be a part of. This service piece, though, I looked around for some old-timers to ask about service opportunities, and after the meeting one day, I go up to the Detroit Dave. He's like our one of our veteran old-timers, and I go up to Dave, and I said, hey, Detroit, I need to get involved in service, and he, like, took a double look, and he's like, you want to get involved in service? Like, he started laughing and telling another guy. I'm like, hey, Dave, what are you talking about here, man? My life's on the line, you know, this is, and he's like, okay, you don't want to get involved. That's great. He's like, come to the business meeting on Thursday, and we'll see about that. You know, ha ha ha. And I was like, all right, whatever, old timers. So I show up to the business meeting, and I leave the group's GSR, and I don't even know what a GSR is at this time. It revolutionized my world and my recovery. It's a group service representative, for those who don't know, and it's basically just like the voice of the group. So what they were doing months after I got out of prison was giving me a check to go to an assembly in another city with a whole bunch of other alcoholics. And, I mean, I had to talk with my PO and get all that approved, but I got it, you know, and I went, and I showed up. I suited up, and I showed up. And when I got there, they had a corrections correspondence, you know, type of meeting, subgroup. And I went in the corrections facilities meeting. I said, hey, you know what? I just got out of prison. I want to give back what was freely given to me. They're like, hey, we're glad you're here, you know. Whatever, we got work for you to do. And a couple, like, assembly later, they ended up nominating me the treasurer of the state of corrections. So they're giving me a checkbook to manage all of the state's money for corrections. And I'm like, I don't even have a checkbook. Like, that's a whole nother amends that, you know, I haven't done yet. Like, I was like, do these people know who I am? Like, did I not say I just got out, you know? And you know, the thing is that they knew exactly who I was. And every cent was accounted for in that checkbook, because, you know, if there wasn't, they'd be looking at me. And after that first assembly, what's amazing about this service is, you know, I knew three people when I moved here, but I now had family from Knoxville to Memphis. And I had people I could call at any point in time, at any point along the journey, and ask for help, or just to say, hey, how's it going? A few months later, my dad's health was not getting better, and it was before my 2-year anniversary, and so I went to my home group and got a medallion for my 1 year, and I was sitting on the couch with him, and I was able to give him my 1-year medallion, and I said, thanks, you know, this, and he looked at it like it was a 50-carat diamond, and it's like, wow, you know, you're my hero, and I mean, that type of gift is priceless. And I was able to be there, two feet down, when he went off into the next life, and there for my mom and my sister. And that's not me. That's not the man that walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in 2008. I'm running from that. I can't take that pain, but you guys showed me how to be there, and you were there. The guys I was sponsoring, they were calling me when I was in the hospital sleeping with my dad with all their problems, and, you know, and I was like, okay, you know, well, mine don't look that bad now. So I continued to do what I was doing, and I got a I got this itch to I was driving down the road, and I saw this register for spring classes, you know, at a community college, and I was like, well, you know, I'm sober now, and maybe I could try going back to school. I tried in the past, but if you don't go, you don't really get far. And I'd find a, you know, a little bottle with legs or whatever you guys call them, and we'd go have fun and never go back to class. But you guys have shown me that, you know, if I suit up and show up, I can do anything. And the book promises me that, you know, I can go places where alcoholics can't go, if I'm assuming I'm in spiritually fit condition. And so I signed up for two classes, just in case, you know, I fell, it wasn't going to be that far. And amazing thing happened. You know, I'm applying the same principles in my home group to class. Suit up, show up, ask questions, do the work, things that you guys taught me. And I start to get good grades for the first time since that horticulture class. And I mean, I'm like, wow, you know, this isn't bad. I'm not as stupid as I thought I was. And I start getting recommended for honors classes, and I start to discover a love for research and reading. And I'm going to be honest with you, I wouldn't tell anybody in the academia this, but, you know, I hadn't read a full book until I was 23 years old in jail awaiting trial. I looked at Cliff Notes. You see, I was smarter than that. Why would you waste your whole time reading a book when you can just look at the Cliff Notes? I can get the idea. But I started this love for learning, and I got to plan my schedule around my home group. And I was going to school, and if you go long enough and you don't miss any classes and you do well, they actually give you a degree. It's really amazing. I got some money for the state to go back, you know, and so I wasn't having to come out of pocket or anything. And I set it as a goal. I wanted to go to business school in Nashville. There's this really good business school for entrepreneurship. And I wrote an email to the dean over there, like, at the beginning of my community college, and I was like, do people from community colleges come there? And he's like, yeah, all the time. So I was like, okay, well. So I just did the work, you know, and like Palmer was talking about, I just one sentence at a time, one assignment at a time, ended up getting into to that private school in Nashville. And I'm still real active in my home group. I'm the DCM. I'm corrections, whatever, and I'm it always been a goal of mine to be able to go into corrections facilities. My PO said, man, it's probably not going to happen. But within about 2 months from getting released and suiting up and showing up at the area assembly, I was taking a weekly meeting into a local detox. Then I was able to take a meeting into the county jail shortly thereafter. And that was some of the most rewarding service that I could do. I don't know if they got anything from it. I just shared with them what I was given. And I left there just feeling like, wow, everything that had happened up to this point in time, you know what? It's okay. God's working it to the good. And that's what's so beautiful about this life that I've been given and that we all have today, is that, you know, there's nothing so bad that has happened up to today that God can't turn into an opportunity for us to help somebody else. Nothing is wasted in God's world. And as I'm going along, I mean, I'm running into fear. I'm in relationships. I'm starting to date a married woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor didn't approve, but I told him that, you know, I got this. And that was right after my dad died, and I kind of leached onto her, and it helped a little bit, but not all the way. And this lasted for 3 years. It was my final semester at this private business school, and she just left, and it was just, kind of feeling. Couldn't even put one shoe on it, you know. It was just, felt horrible. But I knew I needed to finish what I started, a characteristic I didn't have before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I did, one foot in front of the other. And in that last semester, I was offered the opportunity via scholarship to get my master's degree in France, like in across the Atlantic Ocean. And I was like, man, this is crazy. First of all, as soon as they figure out who I am, they're going to take it back. That's always in the back of my mind, keep in mind, because if I'm running the show, there's no room for miracles. But I did what you guys told me. I filled out the paperwork. I went and met with the French consulate in Atlanta, and I did all of these little things. I got a passport somehow. And within 3 months from my heart being ripped out, just about 6 years sober, didn't want to drink, but I was really close to checking myself in somewhere. But I kept putting one foot in front of the other, and I'm on a flight to France to live over there and study. I don't speak the language, but it was an opportunity that, you know, you guys stood behind me and said, you know what, you can do what you want to do. So I did. And had I been in that relationship, I probably would have said thanks for the offer, but I'm content here, drowning in codependency or something. So that started a new adventure, and I was able to plug into Alcoholics Anonymous in France. I didn't know anybody, and just like those first days at a new prison, very scary time. But what I did in France was the same thing I did in a new prison. I prayed with my eyes open, and I sought Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of my understanding, and you guys were there. And I made the beginner's meeting in Paris Saturday mornings at 10:30, my home group. Well, my home away from home group. And they welcomed me in, and I would take a two-hour train every Saturday to get there. I found a temporary sponsor over that way, as they all are, but his name was Tomas, and we had some profound conversations. This one morning, I remember going over there, and the meeting was just bogus. Like, they were talking about all types of, and I was pissed. I was like, man, you know, I just woke up at 5:30 this morning, took a two-hour train over here. Why, you know, this meeting, these people, blah. And he was just like, you know, Matt, he's like, you're only responsible for getting to the meeting. Like, what? Like, did you hear what I said? I was like, okay. Everything after that is not up to you. All right, Thomas, you win. And I've just been blessed with great men in my life. And none of them that I've searched for. They've been placed on my path. The guys that are my sponsors and spiritual teachers, I haven't gone out looking for them. They've been given. They've been just put on my path, and same with the guys I sponsor. God knows I hadn't looked for some of them, but there's nothing I wouldn't do. I couldn't find them. I couldn't make this stuff up. And I'm walking to my home group in Paris, and I'm a couple years ago, and I just began to cry because I'm walking literally the world a free man. It's 8 years to the day, I was sitting inside my world, which was the size of a bathroom. And a man doesn't get from there to here without a lot of help. Without trusting in this God that, you know, I still can't fully understand, but that's not the assignment either. It's just becoming willing to believe that there is one who's more powerful than I am. That's all that's needed to start. And some amazing things have happened, you know, just in God's world in just the last couple years. And I'm going to be ending soon, so thank you for your patience. My shortly after my dad died, I had the privilege of walking my sister down the aisle at her wedding. And for guys like me, you know, guys like us, that's a big deal. And in the last month, or I'd say the last year, that marriage wasn't meant to be or whatever. And so they're getting a divorce. And it's not my instinct to go out there with a shovel and fix it. I'm on recording now saying this, so we're safe. But to be a big brother to this young lady now who I'd pushed away and tried to not let her get in the middle of my tornado is such a gift. And I can never repay you for giving that to me. I'm able to be there for my mom, and she doesn't live too far away, so we make it a point to go and have dinner, you know, at least once a week. And I've been able to help, you know, over the last 8 years with her being single now or you know, widowed, and just to see her faith and continue to see her prayers answered. It's a gift that I was so close to missing. And I'm coming back from France, and there was this one girl that I'd had a little thing with before I'd left, and she'd been on my mind more than once when I was away, and there was other things on my mind too, but this one in particular, and I'd sent her a text when I was back home, and the only reason she responded because she deleted my number, and she didn't know who it was that was asking how you doing. But I convinced her to come over for lunch. She wouldn't do dinner right away because I had hurt her. And I knew that it had to be my best meal. I brought the ingredients from Italy, and I just threw down, and I was like, this has got to be it. And I whipped it up, and it was good enough for dinner. And she didn't make it easy for me to come back into her life because I had hurt her. But I was willing to put in the time and the effort and the love that it took to have another chance. And we ended up getting married, you know, in a short period of time. Not 3 months, but it was like seven. Made sure, you know, I don't want to make sure she doesn't change her mind, and got her. No, why wait? But see, like, you know, I never thought of myself as the type to get married, and all of that stuff that I heard you guys talking about, and seeing my sponsees get, like, you know, things, I mean, the fruits of their labor, and I was like, you know, that's great. I mean, but to now have, like, you know, a person who, she's normal, you know, by all, or not, I don't know, but she puts up with me, and I'm so thankful for that, and, you know, we had a chance to purchase our house, and I just, I don't know, I get really choked up at things like this, because, I mean, they don't happen, when I'm running the show. These are not my plans, guys. Not my plan to go to France. Not my plan to have, you know, really nice women in my life, you know, that aren't stealers like me, and that just think about other people and how they can help. But for the grace of God, you know, and I had the opportunity, you know, last month to go back and pick up my 10-year medallion at the same prison I picked up my 1-year medallion. And that was such an honor to hang out with the guys for a bit. And I almost missed this. I'm going to close with this little piece I love out of A Family Afterwards. And it says that showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. Thank you all so much.